You're listening to a sermon by Don Tykrow, recorded on Sunday, July 13th, 2008, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I'm not sure really how my background is really makes me qualified to be speaking in front of you, other than to say that I do feel very grateful for the opportunity I've had, and perhaps that's why I can speak on generosity. We're continuing our summer series, which we started last week, based on a book which groups the parables perhaps in new and interesting ways. John talked about these parables known as the parables of generosity, but I actually don't think I've ever heard of them referred to that way outside of this particular book. In fact, I had agreed to speak on this particular Sunday, on this particular topic, when Henry Neufeld asked me some time ago, and it was only recently that he actually gave me the passages I was going to be speaking on. And so I had to call Henry right away, and I said, perhaps you've made a mistake. Is there some other ones I could maybe choose on my own? Because I'm not sure that these are the... If I was thinking of generosity, I'm not sure these are the parables I would pick. And if I picked these, I'm not sure I'd be talking about generosity. They are, in fact, very difficult parables, and there is all kinds of things going on there, a good bit of which I'm going to actually ignore and deal with it from my own particular point of view. The book that this is based on, the grouping of parables, I had, for a variety of reasons, I actually didn't read it. So don't blame the author of that particular series if this isn't quite to what you might have thought. So we read two of the parables this morning. And I would like to read the third myself. A young man was visiting Vancouver, staying in one of the downtown hotels. Deciding to visit Gastown and Chinatown, he set off in the early evening to explore. He brought with him his 10-megapixel digital camera, on which he recorded all of his travels, and, of course, his MP3 player, to tune out the sounds of the city. As he walked on his way through the gates of Chinatown, he passed through the downtown east side of Vancouver. Looking like a tourist and unaware of his surroundings with his headphones plugged in, he was soon pulled into a side street by a group of men, struck on the head with a metal pipe, and stripped of all of his belongings. By chance, a minister was walking along the same street when he saw the young traveler lying on the ground, obviously drunk. He moved to the other side of the street and continued on. Soon, a young church worker came along, and seeing the young traveler lying on the side of the street of the downtown east side, obviously another drug addict, he too crossed to the other side of the street and continued on his way. After a time, another man came upon the young traveler lying there on the ground. He himself was a recovering addict. He was a large, heavyset man, with tattoos completely covering both arms and even onto the back of his neck. He lived nearby in the downtown east side, as on his limited salary from washing dishes, it was where he could afford to live. As he lifted the young man, he could see that the blood was still oozing from the open wound on the side of the head where he had been struck. He rinsed the wound with water from his water bottle, tore the arm from his jacket, and tied it around that he had tied around his waist, and bound the young traveler's head to stop the flow of the blood. He then picked him up and set him over the seat of his bike. From there, he took the young traveler to the local clinic where he could be stitched up, and then to his former halfway house where he knew that there would always be a room available for a few days. He gave the manager $100 and told him to look after the young man, and if this was not enough money, he would come back in a few days and he would settle up. I have tried here to rephrase the familiar parable of the Good Samaritan so as to emphasize several key points that I would like to take out of it and also to take this out of our usual and familiar and comfortable way of looking at it. But as I've said before, I'm not necessarily wanting to emphasize the usual points. First, I would like, it should be very clear to us from this parable that the young man was responsible for his own misfortune. Our first reaction when we hear it is to ask ourselves, what kind of idiot walks through the downtown east side at night openly displaying his electronic valuables? Has he not read the paper? Does he not listen to the news? Doesn't he know what's going on? Well, in the story of the Good Samaritan, it would have been very clear to the early listeners that the traveler was foolhardy. The road between Jerusalem and Jericho was a haven for robbers and was known locally as the Red or the Bloody Way. People traveled in groups or even with armed escorts if they were businessmen. The odds of a lone traveler being attacked were very high. So the traveler got what he deserved, and we owe him no pity. In the story, however, he did not get what he deserved. First of all, he received pity. I particularly like the way one Bible translation has it. And it says, he looked at him and he was moved to the depths of his being with pity. The young man received pity and then he received generosity. Let's look at the attitude of a few of the main characters. First of all, we have, what's yours is mine. The robbers had the attitude that as long as they were the bully of the block, they could take whatever they wanted. They had an overpowering attitude. The second attitude was that of the passersby. Both of them had the attitude, what's mine is mine. Since I earned it and I have it, it belongs to me, and I'm not willing to give it to you. I have every right to keep it. We would call this the attitude of stinginess. The third attitude that we find is of the Samaritan. He had the attitude that what's mine is yours. He was willing to use what little he had for the good of others. He was willing to share his ability, his time, his resources for the good of someone in need. He had the attitude of generosity. He was generous. As we continue through the other parables, we will continue to explore what it means to be generous. The second parable is the parable of the vineyard owner. And I would say that this is actually probably quite an unpopular parable. We've already heard it read this morning. The context here is that it's the time of the grape harvest. And it's all hands on deck. The first workers, who probably were the biggest, the youngest, and the strongest, were hired first thing in the morning and promised the pay of a day's wages. This would not have been a generous wage, but it would at least have been a living wage. They could feed their families on a day's wages, but little could probably be saved for the future. The vineyard owner then came back to the labor market a number of times to recruit additional workers, but this time promising them only a fair wage, with no more specifics to it attached than that. But the workers willingly went with him into the vineyard. Finally, with an hour left in the day, the vineyard owner goes back one more time and recruits the last workers. These would probably have been the smallest, oldest, and weakest workers. It is clear from the story, the way it is told, that they had not been lazing around, simply that nobody had been willing to hire them. But by this time, the vineyard owner is desperate, the grapes must be harvested, and off they go to work in the vineyard. Well, we know what happens at the end of the story. All the workers are paid the same wage, which is the daily or living wage promised to the biggest, youngest, strongest workers hired in the morning. Well, this creates a big problem. As a parent, if you ever decide that you really need some trouble in your life, try this. Be generous with your children, but unequally so. Give one or some more than the others, and base it on guidelines known only to you. Also, make sure that the children know exactly what each other have received. Any parent with more than one child knows that from their earliest moments, children have a keenly developed sense of justice and fairness. Just try dividing the dessert, ice cream, or donuts in a way that young children consider unfair. You practically need a jeweler's scale to make everyone happy. But here we're not talking about children's desserts. We're talking about the living wages of men, literally, as the modern saying goes, two paychecks away from serious trouble. Not only did the last hired get paid the same as the first, or in the minds of the first, as they complained, they should have got paid more. What is more, it is doubtful that the physical condition of those hired last would have allowed them to do as much work per day or per hour as the first hired. The first hired would have been the prime physical specimens. But all of this was of no concern to the vineyard owner, who rebuked the complainers, telling them that they had received exactly what they had been agreed upon, and it was none of their business what he did with his money. So there you go, straight from the Bible. Tell those kids and grandkids what you do with your money is none of their business. So the vineyard owner wasn't fair. He may not even have been just, but he was generous. He had no obligation to pay the workers hired during the day a full day's wage. But he did anyways. Unlike the first story, the change in circumstances is this: that the workers were not working was through no fault of their own. They had made themselves available. They simply weren't physically the first to be chosen. But in both parables, the result was the same: generosity. It seems that all of the parables are meant to provoke us in some way, particularly if we can understand them in a modern context. And the sheep and the goats provokes us in many ways, the parable. It's a difficult parable and has many depths of meaning. And many of those depths I'm going to leave for other real theologians. Again, I will concentrate on what I feel are a few of the essential characteristics relating to generosity. Here in this parable, the circumstances change again. In the first two stories, generosity is bestowed on the main character by another. Now, English grammar in high school wasn't my strong point, but we seem to have some sort of direct object, indirect object situation, or protagonist-antagonist. I'm not quite sure. Somebody, I'm sure, will correct me. But in this parable, it is the main character who is practicing the generosity rather than receiving it. It says, "Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes, did we clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?' And the king will reply, 'I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me.'" This parable is very overt in its message about generosity and compassion. So as a group, what do these parables tell us today about generosity? What exactly does being generous mean or entail? I would like to make 4 points. To be generous means to respond to the needs that we see around us, to respond with compassion, to respond with practical help, and finally to respond with follow-up help. The Samaritan responded to the wounded man at the side of the road. The vineyard owner responded to day laborers who needed a living wage. The righteous ones in the third parable saw people who were hungry or thirsty or in prison, and he responded to them. Note that although the circumstances were quite different, there is no discussion in the parable of the merits of the recipients. How often do we decide to help people based on a personal judgment about whether they deserve our aid? We say to ourselves, well, it's their own fault that they are unemployed or pregnant or have AIDS or are on drugs or are in prison. And we're probably right. It probably is their fault. But the biblical example ignores this element of fault and simply responds to needs. I think that one reason for this is that we often do not appreciate the fine line in our own lives that separates success from failure, and the need, and thus need, and how little control we may have over it. We say to ourselves, "There but for the grace of God." But do we mean it? Do we even understand it? A business person can stake his entire equity into a long-term project, the economics of which are completely changed by the time the project is finished. A tornado touches down and destroys a house, leaving the one next to it unscathed. For a farmer, one ill-timed late frost or summer wind hailstorm can have a devastating but local and random effect. There are many examples of misfortune created from being in the wrong place at the wrong time. This, I think, is why the parables ask us to be generous first and foremost, and to respond to the needs around us. We are simply not in a position of evaluating the chain of cause and effect, which may have led to the moment of discovery of need. Compassion can take many forms, and is most useful when it is tied carefully to the needs. Generosity does not simply mean alms for the poor. So often, our only thought of generous means giving to charity, but in fact, it is the least represented in these examples. The Good Samaritan bound the wounds of the injured young man. The vineyard owner gave employment to those who needed work to live. Needs should be met with compassion, but also on their own terms. Martin of Tours was born in 330 AD of pagan parents, but he went on to become a bishop and a theologian. His father was a soldier who enlisted Martin in the army at the age of 15. One winter day, he saw a beggar at the gate of the city. Martin had no money to give, but he cut his cloak in half and gave half to the beggar. The story goes that in a dream that night, Martin saw Christ wearing half of the cloak. St. Francis of Assisi grew up as a spoiled rich child. One day, while crossing the Umbrian plains on horseback, he unexpectedly drew close to a leper. The sudden appearance of this repulsive man filled him with disgust, and he instinctively retreated. But after controlling his natural aversion, he dismounted, embraced the man, and gave him all the money that he had. From that simple first step grew a saint. All three of the parables portray active, practical help: shelter, a job, food, visits. These are the basics of generosity. The more I have understood our history, the more I have been impressed by the practical means Mennonites around the world have used to help those in need. Beginning with the Mennonite Central Committee and continuing on with food aid, halfway houses, seniors' homes, these crucially meet the test of generosity. They deal with needs at hand, they are compassionate, and they provide practical long-term help. A recent article in the Vancouver Sun talked about a growing backlash against religious tourism, as they called it. According to the article, the short-term mission trip is a huge phenomenon that seems to be gaining in momentum. The article stated that the vacationaries particularly decided to go to tropical destinations. In fact, some recent studies showed that the Bahama Islands in the Caribbean received one short stay worker for every 15 inhabitants of the islands. It cited problems encountered in the field, including buildings being painted 6 times in the same year by various groups, and buildings being built for a cost, including the travel spent by the travelers, of $30,000 instead of the local cost of $2,000. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong in these trips, as long as they do not violate the biblical prescription for help and generosity. Too often, we and these trips particularly focus on the needs and wants of the participants and what they will gain from it and the experience they will have, whereas in the parables, the needs of those providing the aids is not even mentioned or only secondarily. All such trips should be evaluated as to whether they are meeting local needs in a practical way and not how they will benefit the contributors. Immediate aid for victims of earthquakes and floods and other natural disasters is important and generous, but the victims are too often soon forgotten as we turn our attention to the latest events from around the world. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, we see that after the injured man is dropped off at the inn, the innkeeper is promised that after a few days he will return and settle up accounts if necessary. One of the commentaries said that one of the most surprising things is that apparently this man's credit was good and that the innkeeper would actually believe him that he would settle up. In these few parables, we are presented with a clear recipe for generosity. Respond to the needs of those around us with compassion and without judgment, not focusing on our own needs, and following up with long-term help as needed.